Did you have a good sweep this time out? Holds are fit to bust, said Drakasha, and we pulled in a little brig, about a 90-footer. Ought to be here by now, actually. That the Red Messenger? How'd you... Strozzi came in just yesterday. Said he swooped down on a brig with bad legs and was about to pluck her when he found one of your prize crews waving at him. This was about 60 miles north of Trader's Gate, just off the Burning Reach. Hell, they might be crawling through Trader's Gate as we speak. More power to them, then. We came in through the parlor. Not good, said Rodanov, looking less than pleased for the first time since he'd come up. Heard some strange things about the parlor lately. His Eminence, the fat bastard. Shipbreaker, Konar whispered to Locke. Sent a lugger east last month and says it got lost in the storm. But I hear from reliable lips that it never made it out of the parlor. I thought speed would be the greater virtue coming in, said Drakasha. But next time back, I'll use the gate if it takes a week. You can pass that around. It'll be my advice, too. Speaking of which, I hear you want to call the council tomorrow. There's 5 of us in town. I've got curious business from Talvara, and I want a closed meeting. One captain, one first, said Rodanov. Right. I'll pass the word to Strozzi and Kolvar tomorrow. I take it Rance already knows?
Yes.
She might not be able to speak.
She won't need to, said Drakasha. I'm the one with the story to tell.
So be it, said Rodanov. Let us speak behind our hands, lest our lips be read as the book of our designs, and let us find some place where only gods and rats may hear our words aloud. Locke stared at Rodanov. That was Lucano from...
The Assassin's Wedding, said Del Mastro.
Yeah, easy, said Rodanov with a grin. Nothing more difficult sprang to mind.
What a curiously theatrical bent you brassy reavers seem to have, said Jean.
I knew Esri had a taste. I only quote Lucarno for her, said Rodanov. I myself hate the bastard. Mawkish sentiment, obvious self-satisfaction, and so many little puns about fucking so all the Therin Throne's best-dressed twits could feel naughty in public. Meanwhile, the Bonds Magi and my ancestors rolled dice to see who got to burn the Empire down first.
Jerome and I are both very fond of Lucarno, said Del Mastro.
And that is because you don't know any better, said Rodanov, because the plays of the early throne poets are kept in vaults by pinheads, while Lucarno's merest specks of vomit are exalted by anyone with coins to waste on scribes and bindery. His plays aren't preserved, they're perpetrated. Mercalor Mentezzo.
Mentezzo's all right, said Jean. His verse is fair, but he uses the chorus like a crutch and always throws the gods in at the end to solve everyone's problems.
Mentezzo and his contemporaries built Therin Throne drama from the Espadri model, said Rodanov, invigorating dull temple rituals with relevant political themes. The limitations of their structure should be forgiven. By comparison, Lucarno had their entire body of work to build upon, and all he added to the mix was tawdry melodrama.
Whatever he added, it's enough that 400 years after the scourging of Therin Pell, Lucarno is the only playwright with Talathri's formal patronage whose work is still preserved in its entirety and regularly prepared in new editions.
An appeal to the tastes of the groundlings is not equivalent to a valid philosophical analysis of the works in question. Lucestra of Nicora wrote in her letters to...
Begging everyone's pardon, said Big Konar,
but it ain't polite to have an argument if nobody else knows what the fuck you're arguing about.
I have to admit that Corna is right, said Drakasha. I can't tell if you two are about to pull steel or found a mystery cult.
Who the hell are you?
Asked Rodanov, his eyes fixed on Jean.
I haven't had anyone to discuss this with for years.
I had an unusual childhood, said Jean. Yourself?
The prevailing vanity of my youth was that the Therin Collegium needed a master of letters and rhetoric named Rodanov.
What happened?
Well, there was a certain professor of rhetoric, see, who'd come up with a foolproof way to run a betting shop out of the Hall of Studious Reflection. Gladiator pits, collegium boat races, that sort of thing. He used his students as message runners, and since money can be used to buy beer, that made him our personal hero. Of course, when he had to flee the city, it was whips and chains for the rest of us. So I signed on for shit work aboard the merchant galleon.
When was this? Interrupted Locke.
Hell, this was back when the gods were young. Must be 25 years.
This professor of rhetoric, was his name Barsavi? Vencarlo Barsavi?
How the hell could you possibly know that?
Might have crossed paths with him a few times. Locke grinned. Traveling in the east, vicinity of Camor.
I heard rumors, said Rodanov. Heard the name once or twice, but never made it to Camor myself. Barsavi, really? Is he still there?
No, said Jean. No, he died a couple of years ago, is what I heard.
Too bad, Rodanov sighed. Too damn bad.
Well, I can tell I've detained you all for too long, flattering about people who've been dead for centuries. Don't take me too seriously, Valora. A pleasure to meet you. You as well, Ravel.
Good to see you, Jafrim, said Zamira, rising from her chair along with him. Until tomorrow, then?
I'll expect the good show, he said. Evening, all!
One of your fellow captains, said Jean, as Rodanov descended the stairs. Very interesting. So why didn't he want our table, then?
Dread Sovereign's the biggest ship any Port Prodigal captain has ever had, said Zamira slowly. And she's got the biggest crew by far. Jafrim doesn't need to play the games the rest of us do, and he knows it.
There was no conversation at the table for several minutes, until Rask suddenly cleared his throat and spoke in a low, gravelly voice.
I saw a play once, he said. It had this dog that bit a guy in the balls.
Yeah, said Malakasti. I saw that too. "'Cause the dog loves sausage, and the man is always feeding him sausage, and then he takes his breeches off.'
"'Right,' said Drakasha. "'The very next person who mentions a play of any sort is going to swim back to the orchid. "'Let's go see how badly our friend Banjit Alvo wanted his silver.' 9. Regal woke Locke the next day just in time for the noon watch change. Locke plucked the kitten off the top of his head, stared into his little green eyes, and said,
"'This may come as quite a shock to you, but there is just no way in all the hells that I'm getting attached to you, you sleep-puncturing menace!'
Locke yawned, stretched, and walked out into the soft, warm rain, falling from a sky webbed by cataracts of cloud.
"'Ah,' he said, stripping to his breeches and letting the rain wash some of the smell of the tattered crimson from his skin.
It was strange, he reflected, how the myriad stinks of the poison orchid had become familiar, and the smell of the sort of places he'd spent years in had become intrusive. Drakasha had shifted the orchid to a position just off one of the long stone piers in the hospital anchorage, and Locke saw that a dozen small boats had come up along the larboard side. While five or six armed Blue Watch held the entry port, Utgard and Zamira were negotiating vigorously with a man standing atop a launch filled with pineapples. The early afternoon was consumed by the coming and going of boats. Assorted prodigals appeared offering to sell everything from fresh food to alchemical drugs, while representatives from the independent traders came to inquire about the goods in the hold and view samples under Drakasha's watchful eye. The orchid temporarily became a floating market square. Around the second hour of the afternoon, just as the rain was abating and the sun burning through the clouds above, the red messenger appeared out of the trader's gate passage and dropped anchor beside the orchid. Nazreen, Gwillem, and the prize crew came back aboard, along with several of the ex-messengers who'd recovered enough to move around.
"What the hell is he doing here?" one of them hollered when he saw Locke.
"Come with me," said Jabril, putting an arm around the man's shoulder. "Nothing I can't explain. And while I'm at it, I'll tell you about a thing called the Scrub Watch."
Scholar Tregan ordered a boat lowered so she could visit the messenger and examine the injured still aboard her. Locke helped hoist the smallest boat down, and while he was doing so, Tregan crossed paths with Gwillem at the entry port.
"We've traded cabins," she said gruffly. "I've got your old compartment, and you can have mine."
"What?
What?
Why?"
"You'll find out soon enough."
Before the Vadran could ask any more questions, Tregan had clambered over the side and Zamira had taken him by the arm. "What sort of bid will the shipbreaker open with for her?"
"Two silvers and a cup of cowpox, Scabs," said Gwillem.
"Yes, but what can I reasonably talk him up to?"
1100 or 1200 solari. He's going to need two new topgallant masts, as the fore was sprung as well. It just didn't come down. New yards, some new sails. She's had work done recently, and that's a help, but a look at her timbers will show her age. She's got maybe 10 years of use left in her."
"Captain Drakasha," said Locke, stepping up beside Gwillem, "if I may be so bold, this scheme you were talking about, Ravel? I'm sure I can squeeze at least a few hundred more solari out of him."
"Ravel?" Gwillem frowned at him. "Ravel, the former captain of the Red Messenger?"
"Delighted to meet you," said Locke. "And all I need to borrow, Captain, are some better clothes, a few leather satchels, and a pile of coins."
"What?"
"Relax, I'm not going to spend them. I just need them for show. And you'd better let me have Jerome as well."
"Captain," said Gwillem, "why is Orin Ravel alive and a member of the crew and asking you for money?"
"Del," hollered Drakasha. "Right here," she said, appearing a moment later. "Del, take Gwillem aside and explain to him why Orin Ravel is alive and a member of the crew."
"But why is he asking you for money?" said Gwillem.
Ezri grabbed him by the arm and pulled him away.
"My people expect to be paid for the messenger," said Drakasha. "I need to be sure whatever you're scheming won't actually make things worse."
"Captain, in this matter, I'd be acting as a member of your crew. Lest you forget, I have a share of what we get for the messenger, too."
"Hmm." She looked around and tapped her fingers on the hilt of one of her sabers. "Better clothes, you say?" 10. The shipbreaker's agents, primed by rumors from the night before, were swift to spot the new sail in Prodigal Bay. At the fifth hour of the afternoon, an ornate barge rowed by banks of slaves pulled alongside the Red Messenger. Drakasha waited to receive the occupants of the barge with Delmastro, Gwillem, and 24 armed crewfolk. First up the side was a squad of guards, men and women sweating beneath armor of boiled leather and chain. Once they'd swept the deck with their eyes, a team of slaves leapt aboard and rigged lines to haul a hanging chair from barge to ship. Sweating furiously, they strained to heave this chair and its occupant up to the entry port. The shipbreaker was exactly as Drakasha remembered, an old, paper-skinned Therin so distended with fat
that it looked as though he'd popped his seams and his viscous flesh was pouring out into the world around him. His jowls ended somewhere below the middle of his neck, his fingers were like burst sausages, and his wattles had so little firmament behind them they quivered when he blinked. He managed to rise from his chair with the help of a slave at either hand, but he didn't look remotely comfortable until another slave produced a wide lacquered shelf, a sort of portable table. This was set before him, and he heaved his massive belly atop it with a groan of relief.
"A limping brig," he said to no one in particular. "One t'gallant mast gone, and the other one fit for firewood. Somewhat aged. A lady whose fading charms are ill-concealed by recent layers of paint and gilt. Oh, forgive me, Zamira, I did not see you standing there."
"Whereas I felt the ship heel over the instant you came aboard," said Drakasha. "She was tough enough to pull through a summer's end storm even in the hands of an incompetent. Her lines are clean, topgallant masts are cheap, and she's sweeter by far than most of the heaps you haul to the east."
"Heaps procured for me by captains like yourself. Now, I want to peek under her breeches and see if she has any quim left to speak of. Then we can discuss the size of the favor I'll be doing you."
"Pose all you like, old man. I'll have a fair price for a fair ship." "Fair she is," said Leocanto Costa, choosing that moment to emerge from his lurking place within the companionway. The orchid's little store of fine clothing had furnished him with a veneer of wealth. His mustard-brown coat had cloth of silver cuffs, his tunic was unstained silk, his breeches were passable, and his shoes were polished. They were also large enough for a man of Jerome's build, but Costa had stuffed them with rags to help them fit. One couldn't have everything. A borrowed rapier hung from his belt, and several of Zamira's rings gleamed on his fingers. Behind him came Jerome, dressed as the dutiful manservant of common demeanor, carrying three heavy leather satchels over his shoulder. The speed with which they'd assumed these roles led Zamira to infer they'd used them elsewhere. "My lord," said Drakasha, "have you finished your inspection?"
"I have, and, as I said, fair. Not excellent, but hardly a death trap. I can see 15 years in her with a bit of luck."
"Who the fuck might you be?"
The shipbreaker regarded Costa with eyes like a bird suddenly confronted by a rival's beak just as it's about to seize a worm.
"Tavrin Callus," said Costa. "Lashane."
"Appear?"
asked the shipbreaker.
"Of the third. You don't need to use my title."
"Nor will I. Why are you sniffing around this ship?"
"Your skull must be softer than your belly. I'm angling to buy her from Captain Drakasha."
"I am the one who buys ships in Prodigal Bay."
"By what? The writ of the gods? I'm in funds, and that's all that signifies."
"Your funds won't help you swim, boy."
"Enough," said Drakasha. "Until one of you pays for it, this is my ship you're standing on."
"You're very far from home, pup, and you cross me at your—"
"You want this ship, you pay full weight of metal for it." Drakasha seethed, her irritation genuine.
The shipbreaker was powerful and useful, but in a contest of sheer force, any brass sea captain could crush him beneath their heel. Lack of competition led him to presume too much upon the patience of others.
"If Lord Callus tenders the best offer, I'll take it from him. Are we through being foolish?"
"I'm prepared to buy my ship," said Costa.
"Now hold it, Captain," said Del Mastro on cue. "We know the shipbreaker can pay, but we've yet to see the lordship's coin."
"Del's right," said Drakasha. "We use letters of credit to wipe our asses down here, Lord Callus. You'd best have something heavy in those bags."
"Of course,"
said Costa, snapping his fingers. Jerome stepped forward and dropped one satchel on the deck at Drakasha's feet. It landed with a jangling clink.
Gwilym, she said, motioning him forward. He crouched over the satchel, unbound its clasps, and revealed a pile of gold coins. In actuality, a combination of Zamira's ship's purse and the funds Leocanto and Jerome had brought to sea. Gwilym lifted one, held it up to the sunlight, scratched it, and bit it. He nodded.
The real thing, Captain. Tal Varar Solari.
700 in that bag, said Costa, which was the cue for Jerome to throw the second one down on the deck beside it.
700 more.
Gwilym unclasped the second satchel, allowing the shipbreaker to see that it too was apparently brimming with gold. At least it was for 5 or 6 layers of Solari above a silk pocket filled with silvers and coppers. The third satchel was as much a sham, but Zamira hoped that Costa wouldn't have to make his point again.
"And from that," said Leocanto, "I'll give you 1,000 to commence." "The edges of his coins could be shaved," said the shipbreaker. "This is intolerable, Drakasha. Bring scales from your ship, and I'll have mine fetched up."
"These coins are pristine," said Costa, gritting his teeth. "Every last one. I know you'll check them, Captain, and I know what my life would be worth if you found any of them debased."
"But..."
"Your deep concern for my welfare is noted, shipbreaker," said Drakasha. "But Lord Kallus is entirely correct, and I judge him sincere. He offers 1,000. Do you wish to better that?"
"Legs are open, old man," said Leocanto. "Can you really get it up?"
1,010, said the shipbreaker.
1,100, said Costa. "Gods, I feel like I'm playing cards with my stable hands."
1,100, wheezed the shipbreaker, "and 50.
1,200.
I have yet to examine her timbers."
"Then you should have hauled yourself across the bay faster. 1,200.
1,300.
"That's the spirit," said Costa. "Pretend you can keep up with me. 1,400.
1,500, said the shipbreaker. "I warn you, Kallus, if you push this price higher, there will be consequences."
Poor old lard bucket, forced to make do with a merely ridiculous profit rather than an obscene one. 1,600.
"Where did you come from, Kallus?"
"Booked passage on an independent trader."
"Which one?"
"None of your God's damned business. I'm good for 16. What a..."
18,
hissed the shipbreaker.
"Are you running out of purses, you Lashani pretender?"
19, said Costa, injecting a note of concern into his voice for the first time.
2,000 solari.
Leocanto made a show of conferring briefly with Jerome. He looked down at his feet, muttered,
"Fuck you, old man," and gestured for Jerome to collect the satchels from the deck.
"To the shipbreaker," said Zamira, suppressing a huge smile, "for 2,000.
"Ha!"
The shipbreaker's face became contorted with triumph that looked nearly painful.
"I could buy 10 of you on a whim, whelp. If I ever felt the need to scabbard my cock in something foreign and useless."
"Well, you won," said Leocanto. "Congratulations. I'm ever so chagrined."
"You should be," said the shipbreaker, "since you're suddenly standing on my ship. Now I'd like to hear what you'll bid to keep me from having you spitted over a fire."
"Shipbreaker," said Drakasha, "until I see 2,000 solari in my hands, like all hells is this your ship."
"Ah," said the old man, "a technicality.
He clapped his hands, and his slaves sent the hoist chair back to the barge, presumably to be loaded with gold.
"Captain Drakasha," said Costa, "thank you for your indulgence, but I know when it's time to withdraw."
"Del," said Drakasha, "show Lord Cullis and his man to one of our boats. Lord Cullis, you're welcome to stay for dinner in my cabin. After that, we can send you back where you belong."
"Indebted to you, Captain."
Costa bowed more deeply than strictly necessary, and then vanished through the entry port with Del Mastro and Jerome.
"Got the wet-eared little prick," said the shipbreaker loudly. "Keep his money."
"I am content with yours," said Zamira. "Besides, I'm rather taken with the idea of having a genuine Lashani baron convinced that he owes me his life." The shipbreaker's slaves transferred bag after bag of coins to the deck of the messenger, silver and gold, until the agreed-upon price was heaped at Zamira's feet. Gwilym would count it all at leisure, of course, but Zamira felt no anxiety about fraud or debasing. The sacks would contain exactly what they were supposed to, by the logic Tavrin Callas had espoused a few minutes earlier. The shipbreaker kept a dozen well-equipped mercenaries at his fortified estate on the edge of town, but if he cheated a captain, he'd have pirates after him in platoons, and his running days were a distant memory. Drakasha left the messenger in the hands of the shipbreaker's guards and slaves, and was back aboard the Orchid within half an hour, feeling the contentment that always came with seeing a prize sold off. One less complication to plan around. Now her entire crew would be back on one hull, shares would be made, the ship's purse substantially enriched. The injured ex-messengers who hadn't been with them for the Kingfisher sacking presented a slight problem, but to a man they'd opted for the temporary indignity of the scrub watch, if the alternative was to be left in Prodigal in ill health.
"Ravel, Valora," she said, finding the pair of them sitting in the undercastle shade, talking and grinning along with Del and a dozen crew folk. "That went better than I expected."
700 or 800 more than what we might have had otherwise," said Gwilym with surprise.
"That much more fat to marble everyone's cut," said Valora.
"Until the bastard spends some money to check up on the independent traders," said Del, one eyebrow raised in mingled admiration and disbelief, "when he discovers that nobody's brought any Lashani noble anywhere near Prodigal recently."
"Of course he'll figure out what happened sooner or later," Costa waved a hand dismissively.
"That's the beauty of it. That sort of uptight, self-loving, threat-making little tyrant, well, you can play him like a piece of music. Never in 1,000 years would he run around letting anyone else know that you suckered him in broad daylight with such a simple trick. And with the profit margin he scrapes out of every ship he takes from you, there's just no way in hell he'll hit back with anything but fussy words."
"He's got no power to push, if pushing's what comes to his mind," said Zamira.
"I call the deed well done. Doesn't mean you can lounge around in those fancy clothes all evening, though. Get them stowed again."
"Of course, Captain."
"And whether or not the shipbreaker bites his tongue, I think it best to keep you two out of sight for the rest of our time here. You're both confined to the ship."
"What? But..."
"I believe," said Drakasha, in an amused but firm tone of voice, "that it might not be wise to let a pair such as you off the leash too frequently. I'll give you a little something extra from the ship's purse for your trouble."
"Oh, fair enough." Costa began removing the more delicate components of his fine costume. "I suppose I've got no particular urge to get my throat slit in an alley anyway."
"Wise lad." Zamira turned to Del Mastro. "Del, let's get a list together for tonight's merry watch. They can go ashore with us when we head in for the council. Let's say 1/2 the ship's company. Make it fair."
"Right," said Del. and until we come back from that meeting, they can wait in the boats, conveniently watching for trouble, can't they?
Exactly, said Zemira. Same as all the other crews, I expect.
Captain, Del whispered almost into Zemira's ear, what the hell is this meeting about?
Bad business, Ezri.
She glanced at Leocanto and Jerome, smiling and joking with one another, oblivious of her scrutiny.
Bad if it's true, bad if it's not.
She put an arm on Ezri's shoulder. This young woman who'd turned her back on life as a pampered Nikoran aristocrat, who'd risen from scrub watch to first mate, who'd nearly been killed a dozen times in half that many years to keep Zamira's precious orchid afloat.
Some of the things you'll hear tonight concern Valora. I can't guess what you two have spoken of in private, in those rare interludes where you two spend your private moments speaking.
Ezri thrust out her chin, smiled, and didn't deign to blush.
But what I have to say may not please you. If there's anything to be settled between us, said Ezri softly, I trust him to settle it, and I'm not afraid to hear anything.
My Ezri, said Zemira.
Well then, let's get dressed to go meet the relations. Armor and sabers. Oil your scabbards and wet your knives. We might need the tools to make some parting arguments if the conversation goes poorly.
Chapter 13. Points of Decision. 1. A mile of lonely beach separates Port Prodigal from the ruins of its fallen stone sentinel, Castana Voressa, Fort Glorious. Built to dominate the northern side of the bay serving Fort Glorious before a shift in the fortunes of the Ghost Winds brought an equivalent change to the city's name, the fort would not now suffice to ward off an attack with vulgar language, let alone the blades and arrows of a hostile force. To say that it was constructed cheaply would be an injustice to skinflint stonemasons. Several whole shiploads of Ferrari granite blocks were diverted into the home-building trade for wine money by bored officials far from home. Grand plans for walls and towers became grand plans for a wall, and finally modest plans for a smaller wall with barracks, and as a capstone to the entire affair, the garrison of soldiers intended for those barracks was lost in transit to a summer's end storm. The only useful remnant of the fort is a circular stone pavilion about 50 yards offshore, linked to the main ruins by a wide stone causeway. This was intended to be a platform for catapults, but none ever came. Nowadays, when the pirate captains of Port Prodigal call a council to discuss their affairs, this pavilion is always the place and dusk is always the time. Here the captains do business in private, standing on the stones of a Ferrari empire that never was, atop the frustrated ambitions of a city-state that had nonetheless frustrated their own ambitions 7 years before. 2. It began as every such meeting Zemira could remember, under the purple-red sky of sunset, with lanterns set out atop the old stones, with the humid air thick as an animal's breath, and the biting insects out in force. There was no wine, no food, and no sitting when the Council of Captains was called. Sitting only made people more inclined to waste time. Discomfort stripped sentiment from everyone's words and brought them to the heart of their problems with haste. To Zamira's surprise, she and Ezri were the last to arrive. Zemira glanced around at her fellow captains, nodding cordially as she eyed them all in turn. First there was Rodanov, armed now, with his first mate, Idrena Koros, a trim blonde woman only slightly taller than Ezri. She had the poise of a professional duelist and a reputation with the wide-bladed Gereshti scimitar. Beside them stood Piero Strozzi, an amiable bald fellow pushing 50, waited on by his lieutenant, called Ear-Taker Jack, for what he liked to slice from the heads of his fallen foes. It was said that he tanned them and sewed them into elaborate necklaces, which he kept locked in his cabin. Rance was there, with Valtero at her shoulder as usual.
The right side of Rance's jaw was several wince-inducing shades of black and green, but she was standing on her own 2 feet, and at least had the courtesy not to glare at Zemira when she thought Zemira was watching. Last but not least was Jacqueline Colvard, the so-called old woman of the Ghost Winds, still elegant in her mid-60s, if grey-haired and sun-scorched like old leather. Her current protégé, and therefore lover, was Maressa Vicente, whose fighting and sailing qualities were not yet generally known. The young woman certainly looked capable enough. Until one of them walked away, then, they were effectively sealed off here from the rest of the world. Parties from their crews, about half a dozen from each ship, mingled uneasily at the end of the causeway. No one else would be permitted to walk upon it until they finished. So, Zemira thought, how will we do this?
Zemira, said Rodanov, you're the one who called the council. Let's hear what's on your mind.
Straight to the action, then.
Not so much on my mind, Jafrim, as on all of our heads. I have evidence that the Archon of Tal Verar may have inconvenient plans for us once again.
Once again? Rodanov made fists of his huge hands. It was Bonaire who had the inconvenient plans, Zemira. We should have expected Stragos to do what any one of us would have done in his place.
I haven't forgotten so much as a day of that war, Jafrim.
Zemira felt her hackles rise despite her determination to be patient. You know very well that I've come to call it a mistake.
The lost cause, snorted Rodanov. More like the dumb fucking idea. Would that you'd seen it for folly at the time.
Would that you'd done more than talk at the time, said Strozzi mildly. Talked and sailed away when the Archon's fleet darkened the horizon.
I never joined your damned armada, Piero. I offered to try and draw some of his ships off, and that much I did. Without my help, you'd have lost the weather gauge sooner and been flanked from the north. Chavon and I would be the only captain standing here.
Stand off, shouted Zemira. I called the council, and I have more to tell. I didn't bring us here to salt old wounds.
Speak on, said Strozzi.
A month ago, a brig left Tal Verar. Her captain stole her from the Sword Marina.
There was a general outburst of muttering and head-shaking at that. Zemira smiled before continuing.
For crew, he stole into Windward Rock and emptied a vault full of prisoners. His intention, and theirs, was to sail south and join us in Port Prodigal, to fly the red flag.
Who could steal one of the Archon's ships from a guarded harbor?
Rodanov spoke as if he only half believed the possibility.
I'd like to meet him.
You have, said Zemira. His name is Orin Ravel.
Valtero, previously silent behind Captain Rance, sputtered,
"There, fucking little!"
Quiet, said Zemira. Lost your purse last night, didn't you? Ravel has fast hands. Fast hands, a quick mind, a talent for command, and a way with a blade. He earned his way onto my crew by killing 4 Jeremite Redeemers by himself.
Zemira felt vaguely amused to be talking Costa up with the same half-truths he'd worked so hard to disabuse her of.
Yet you said he had his own ship, said Rodanov.
Yes, the Red Messenger, sold off to the shipbreaker just this afternoon. Piero, you saw it off the Burning Reach a few days ago, didn't you?
Indeed.
There I was, going about my business, innocently scooping up prizes here and there on the Sea of Brass, said Zemira, when I happened upon Ravel's messenger. Interrupted his plans, to say the least. I poked holes in his story until I squeezed it all out of him, more or less.
What story is that?
Rance sounded as though she had a collection of small rocks in her mouth, but she made herself understood.
Think about it, Rance,
Who is Ravel? One man, a thief, clearly, trained to do many unusual things. But could one man sail a brig out of the gated harbours in the Sword Marina? Could one man break into Windward Rock, overcome every guard there, free an entire vault full of prisoners, and pack them off in his brig, conveniently stolen the very same night?
Said Rance.
Well, possibly.
He didn't do it alone. Colvard spoke for the first time, quietly, but her voice drew the eyes of everyone on the pavilion.
Stragos must have let him escape.
Precisely, said Zemira. Stragos let him escape. Stragos gave him a crew of prisoners eager for any sort of freedom. Stragos gave him a ship, and he did all this knowing full well that Ravel would sail south, come down to join us in our trade.
He wanted an agent among us, said Strozzi, uncharacteristically excited.
Yes, more than that. Zemira gazed around the circle of pirates, ensuring that she had their undivided attention before she continued.
He has an agent among us, aboard my ship. Orin Ravel and his companion Jerome Valora are currently in the Archon's service.
Ezri whipped her head around to stare at Zemira, mouth open. Zemira squeezed her arm unobtrusively.
Kill them, said Colvar.
The situation is more complicated and more grave than that, said Zemira.
Grave indeed, for these two men you speak of. I find it best to make corpses of complications.
Had I discovered their deceit on my own, it would already be done. But Ravel is the one who confessed these things to me. He and Valora are, by his claim, entirely unwilling agents. Stragos gave them a latent poison, to which he alone supposedly holds the antidote. Another month will bring them due for their next dose.
Death would be a favor, then, mumbled Rance. That bastard will never let them be anything but puppets.
Rodanoff waved for her to pipe down.
What, to hear it from Ravel's lips, was their mission? To spy on us, I presume?
No, Jafrim. Zemira put her hands behind her back and began to slowly pace the center of the pavilion.
Stragos wants us to do him the favor of flying the red flag in sight of Tal Vahrah again.
That makes no sense, said Strozzi.
It does when you consider the Archon's needs, said Colvard.
How?
Rance and Strozzi spoke in unison.
I hear that things are brittle between the Archon and the Priori, said Colvard. If something were to come along and put a fright into the fine citizens of Tal Vahrah, their regard for the army and navy would rise.
Stragos needs a foe from outside Tal Vahrah, said Zemira. He needs it with all haste, and he needs to be assured that his forces can kick it around with a will.
She spread her arms wide toward her fellow captains and their mates.
We might as well be painted like archery butts.
There's no profit, said Strozzi, in bringing a fight to us.
For those that take their profit in coin, you're right. But for Stragos it means everything. He gambled a ship, a crew of prisoners, and his very reputation on Ravel's mission. You don't think he's serious? He made a laughingstock of himself by allowing a pirate to escape from his secure harbors, all so he could wait to redeem himself by crushing us later. Zemira brought her fists together.
That was Ravel's task. Convince us, trick us, lie to us, bribe us. And if we couldn't be made to serve, his plan was to do it himself, in the messenger.
Then our course is obvious, said Rodanoff. We don't give Stragos a damn thing. We don't dance around his noose. We keep 500 miles between ourselves and Tal Vahrah, as we have since the war. If need be, we play meek for a few months.
He reached over and gave Strozzi's paunch a hearty slap.
We live off our fat.
If we do that much, said Idrena Koros, begging your pardon, Captain, this evidence of yours, Captain Drakasha, the word of these two men seems thinner than...
Not just their word, said Zamira. Think, Koros, they had the Red Messenger. Its crew, the survivors of which are now my crew, did indeed come from Windward Rock. The Archon sent them, all right.
I concur, said Kolvar. Though I also agree with Jafrim that standing down from provocation is the wisest...
Would be the wisest, interrupted Zamira. If Stragos was doing this on a whim, but he's not, is he? He's in the fight of his life. His very position is at stake. He needs us.
She paced the center of the pavilion again, reminded of the arguments she'd put forth over the years in her pretend turns as a magistrate for initiation rituals. Were these theatrics any more convincing? She hoped to the gods they were.
If we tip Ravel and Valora over the side and ignore them, she said, or shy away from Tal Vahrah, Stragos will try something else, some other scheme to trick us into a fight, or to convince his people that we're bringing one. Only next time the gods may not see fit to allow the instruments of his design to fall into our hands. We'll be blind.
There's more hypothesis here, said Rodanov, than just about anything I ever heard at the Collegiums.
The Red Messenger and the prisoners do indicate that Stragos took a gamble, said Colvard. That he took a gamble indicates that he can't move openly or with confidence. Knowing what we do of the situation in Tal Vahrah, I'd say this threat is real. If Stragos requires an enemy, we are the only suitor at this dance that fits his need. What else can he do? Pick a fight with Balinel, Camor, Lashane, Carthane? I hardly think so.
What would you have us do, Zamira?
Rodanov folded his arms and scowled.
We possess the means to strike back at the Archon.
We can't fight the Varari navy, said Rodanov, nor can we storm the damn city, summon lightning from the sky, or ask the gods to politely dispose of Stragos for us. So by what means may we strike back? Wound his feelings with vicious letters?
Ravel and Valora are expected to report directly to him when they receive their antidote.
They have access to him, said Kolvar. An assassination,
for which they suffer the blame, assuming they live, mused Strozzi.
Good for them, said Rodanov. And what, you wished our consent to take them back to Tal Vahrah and let them loose? By all means, let fly. I'd be happy to lend them a pair of knives.
There is, from the perspective of Ravel and Valora, only one minor complication, that they would prefer to acquire a permanent antidote, and then do away with Stragos.
Alas, said Rance, we so rarely realize our desires in life.
Tell them that we have an antidote, said Kolvar. Convince them that we have the means to free them from their condition, then set them loose upon the Archon. Whether they survive the assassination or not will be of no consequence.
Ezri opened her mouth to disagree, and Zamira fixed her with the most withering glare in her long-practiced arsenal.
"Marvelously devious,"
said Zamira, when she was certain that Ezri would mind herself. "But too convenient. In their position, would you ever believe such a claim?"
"My skull is beginning to spin," said Strozzi. "What the hell do you wish to do, Zamira?"
"I wish," she said, enunciating each word very carefully, for none of you to be alarmed if I should find it necessary to raise a bit of ruckus in the immediate vicinity of Tal Vahrah.
And thereby call down our destruction, shouted Rodanov. Do you want to see Port Prodigal sacked like Montier? Do you want to see us scattered halfway across the world, and our unguarded trade routes filled with angry Ferrari warships?
If I do anything,
said Zamira. Discretion would be...
Impossible, growled Rodanov. This will finish the job Stragos began when he crushed the Free Armada. This will destroy our way of life.
Or preserve it. Zamira put her hands on her hips. If Stragos is determined to push us, he will push us, whether we would dance his tune or no. I have aboard my ship our means, our only means, of taking the fight to him. If Stragos is knocked aside, the Archonate falls with him. And if the Priori rule Tal Vahrah, we can loot this sea at our own merry pace until the day we die.
Why, said Strozzi, would you want to play along with the Archon's design, even with discretion?
Ravel and Valora aren't saints, said Zamira. They're not looking to throw their lives away for our benefit. They want to live, and to do that they need time. If Stragos believes they're hard at work on his behalf, he'll grant them the weeks or months necessary to find a solution. And in the meantime, he's likely to stay his other plans.
Those weeks and months may instead be time enough for him to rouse his city, said Rodanov.
You must trust me to be delicate, said Zamira. As brother and sister captains, that's what I'm asking in the end. No matter what you hear from Tal Vahrah, trust my judgment.
A significant request, said Kolvar. You ask no aid from any of us?
I can't think of anything that would be more counterproductive than for all of us to show up one morning off Tal Vahrah, can you? The Archon would have his war in about 10 minutes. So leave this task to me, a risk to my ship alone.
A risk to us all, said Rodanov. You're asking us to put our fates and that of Port Prodigal in your hands, without any oversight.
How has it been otherwise these past 7 years?
She stared around the circle at each captain in turn.
Each of us has always been at the mercy of the others. Any one of us could have raided too far north, attacked a ship carrying someone's royal cousin, murdered too many sailors, or simply grown too greedy to ignore. We've been in peril all the way. I'm merely doing you the courtesy of pointing it out in advance for once.
And if you fail? Asked Rance.
If I fail, said Zamira, there'll be no penalty for you to levy. I'll already be dead.
Our oaths of non-interference, said Colvard. That's what you want, isn't it? A promise to keep our swords in their scabbards while you throw the most important rule of our association out your stern window.
In lieu of any better alternatives, said Zamira. Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking for.
And if we say no? Rodanov spoke quietly. If we, 4 against 1, forbid this?
Then we come to a line that we all fear to cross, said Zamira, matching his stare.
I won't forbid it, said Rance. I vow to keep my hands off you, Zamira. If you sweat for my gain, so much the better. And if you die in the process, I'll mourn you not. I'll give my oath as well, said Colvard. Zamira's right. Our collective safety at any given time depends on whichever one of us is the bloody craziest. If there's a chance to kick Maxilan off his pedestal, I pray for your success.
Obviously Zamira Drakasha votes with Zamira Drakasha, Zamira said, turning her gaze to Rodanov and Strozzi.
I don't like any of this, said Strozzi. But if things go to shit, no ship afloat on this sea can run like my Osprey.
He smiled and cracked his knuckles. What the hell? You wave your skirt at the Archon and see if he's up for a fondle. I won't be anywhere near it.
It seems, said Rodanov once all eyes had turned to him, that I have the opportunity to be unsociable.
He sighed and rubbed his forehead. I don't think any of this is wise, but if I may take your promise of discretion to be as binding as my oath of non-interference, very well. Go spring this insane scheme.
Thank you,
said Zemira, feeling a warm flush of relief from head to toe. Wasn't that easier than cutting one another to pieces?
This needs to stay between us, said Colvard. I don't ask for an oath, I expect it. Stragos may have other eyes and ears in Prodigal. If this gets out to anyone not standing here, the time we've spent at this meeting, not to mention Zamira's mission, will be an utter waste.
Right, said Strozzi. Silence. All gods as our witness. All gods as our witness, the others echoed.
Will you leave immediately? Asked Colvard.
My crew needs a night ashore. I can't ask them back out without that much. I'll send them in halves, sell off the rest of my swag as fast as I can, clear the harbor in 2 or 3 days.
3 weeks to Tal Vahrah, said Rodanov.
Right, said Zemira. No point in any of this if our lads drop dead en route. I intend to be hasty.
She stepped up to Rodanov, put one hand on his right cheek, and stood on her toes to kiss his other.
Jafrim, have I ever let you down?
Never since the war, said Rodanov. Ah, shit. Even that was a poor thing to say. Don't put me on the spot like this, Zemira. Just don't fuck this up.
Hey, said Colvard. How can I get some of that attention?
I'm feeling generous, but keep your hands to yourself if you prefer to keep them attached. She smiled, kissed Colvard in the middle of her wrinkled forehead, and gave the old woman a hug. Gingerly, because it took pains to accommodate all the swords and daggers the two of them were wearing.
Always thus, thought Zemira, always thus in this life.
3. Utgar was the one waiting at the entry port to offer a hand when Zemira and Ezri went back up the side of the poison orchid. It was 10:30 the 10th hour of the evening.
Welcome back, Captain! How you be?
I've spent the day arguing with the shipbreaker and the council of captains, Zemira muttered. I require my children and I require a drink. Ezri?
Yes?
You, Ravel, Valora, my cabin immediately.
Once in her cabin, Zemira threw her coat, sabers, elderglass vest and hat haphazardly onto her hammock. She settled onto her favorite chair with a groan and welcomed Paolo and Cosetta onto her lap. She lost herself in the familiar smell of their curly dark hair, and gazed with absolute satisfaction at their little fingers as she caught them in her own rough hands. Cosetta's, still so tiny and uncertain, Paolo's growing longer and more dexterous by the week. Gods, they were growing too fast, too fast. Their familiar chatter calmed her to the marrow. Apparently Paolo had spent the afternoon fighting monsters that lived in her sea-chest, while Cosetta now had plans to grow up to be king of the 7 Marrows. Zemira briefly considered explaining the difference between a king and a queen, and deemed it not worth the effort. Contradicting Cos would only lead to days of circular argument.
"Be king! 7 Marrows!" the little girl said, and Zemira nodded solemnly.
"Remember your poor family when you come into your kingdom, darling."
The door opened and Ezri appeared with Costa and Valora. Or should that be Deferra? Damn these layered aliases.
"Lock the door," said Zemira. "Paolo, fetch Mommy 4 glasses. Ezri, can you do the business on one of those bottles of Lashani Blue? They're right behind you."
Paolo, overawed at his responsibility, set 4 small tumblers out on the lacquered table atop the tea-chests. Costa and Deferra found seats on floor cushions, and Ezri made quick work of the waxed cork sealing the bottle.
The smell of fresh lemons filled the cabin, and Esri filled each tumbler to the brim with wine the color of the ocean depths.
"Alas, I'm bereft of toasts," said Zamira. "Sometimes one merely needs a drink. Have at it."
Holding Kos with her left arm, Zamira downed her wine in one go, relishing the mingled tastes of spice and citrus, feeling the prickles of icy heat slide down her throat.
"Want," said Cosetta.
"This is a mummy drink, Kos, and you wouldn't like its taste."
"Want."
"I said..." "Oh, very well. Can't fear the fire if you don't scald your fingertips."
She poured the merest dash of the blue wine into her tumbler and handed it carefully to Kos. The girl took it up with an expression of the utmost solemnity, tipped it back into her mouth, and then dropped it on the tabletop with a clatter.
"Like piss,"
she hollered, shaking her head.
"There are some drawbacks," said Zamira as she caught the tumbler before it went over the edge, "to raising children among sailors. But then I myself am no doubt making the largest contribution to her vocabulary."
"Piss!"
yelled Cosetta, giggling and immensely pleased with herself. Zamira shushed her.
"I have a toast," said Costa, smirking and raising his glass, "to clear perception. I have just now, after all these weeks, realized who the real captain of this vessel is."
De Ferrer chuckled and clinked tumblers with him. Esri, however, left her wine untouched on the table before her and stared down at her hands. Zamira resolved to make this quick. Esri clearly needed to be alone with Jerome.
"It's like this, Ravel," said Zamira. "I didn't know I'd be arguing for your plan until I found myself doing so."
"So you're taking us..."
"Back to Tal Verar. Yes."
She poured herself another tumbler of wine and took a more conservative sip. "I've convinced the council not to panic if stories come down from the north concerning the mischief we're about to work."
"Thank you, Captain. I..."
"Don't thank me with words, Ravel."
Zamira sipped her wine again and set the tumbler down.
"Thank me by keeping your side of the bargain. Find a way to kill Maxillan Stragos."
"Yes."
"Let me make something else clear."
Zamira carefully turned Cosetta in her arms so that the little girl was looking out across the table, straight at Costa.
"Everyone aboard this ship will be risking their life to give you your chance at this scheme. Every single person."
I understand."
"If time passes and we can't find a solution for what Stragos has done to you, well, your access to him can't last forever. I'll do everything in my power to help you before it comes to that, but if there's no other alternative, if time runs out and the only way you can take him down is to sacrifice yourself, I won't expect to see you again. Do you understand?"
"If it comes to that," said Costa, "I'll drag him to the judgment of the gods with my bare hands. We'll go together."
"Gods," said Cosetta. "Bare hands!"
"Piss!"
shouted Costa, hoisting his tumbler toward Cosetta, who nearly came apart at the joints with the resulting fit of giggles.
"Thank you, Ravel, for this gift of a daughter who will now be up all night repeating that word."
"Sorry, Captain. So, when do we leave?"
"Half the crew goes ashore tonight, and the other half tomorrow. We'll be scraping them up in heaps the day after, those that want to stay with us. Hopefully we can be rid of our swag tomorrow. So, 2 days, 2 and a half maybe, then we'll see how the orchid flies."
"Thanks, Captain."
"And that's all," Zamira said. "My children are up too late, and I intend to claim the privilege of snoring as loudly as I wish once you're all out of my cabin."
Costa was the first to take the hint, draining his glass and leaping to his feet. De Ferrer followed, and was about to leave when Esri spoke in a quiet voice.
"Jerome, may I see you in my cabin? Just for a few minutes?"
"A few minutes?"
Jerome grinned. "Ezra, when did you become such a pessimist?"
"Now," she said, wiping the smile from his face. Chagrined, he helped her to her feet. A moment later, the door to her cabin clicked shut, leaving Zamira alone with her family in one of the quiet interludes that were so damnably rare. For a few brief moments every night, she could imagine that her ship was travelling neither to nor from danger, and she could imagine herself more mother than captain, alone with the ordinary concerns of her children.
"Mommy," said Paolo, without any warning, "I want to learn how to fight with a sword."
Zamira couldn't help herself. She stared at him for several seconds and then cracked up laughing. Ordinary? Gods, how could any child born to this life be anything resembling ordinary?
"Sword!"
hollered Cosetta, possible future king of the Seven Marrows.
"Sword! Sword!"
4. Ezra, He saw the slap coming, but it never occurred to him for an instant to try to prevent the blow from landing. She put all of her muscle into it, which was saying something, and tears blurred Jean's vision.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Tell you?" She was sobbing now, but her next punch landed on his right arm with undiminished force.
"Ow!"
he said.
"What? What? Why didn't you tell me?"
It was almost a shout. He spread his hands to catch her fists. A punch from her to the ribs or solar plexus, and he'd feel it for hours.
"Ezra, please! Tell you what?"
He knelt on the narrow floor of her compartment, kissing her fingertips while she tried to yank her hands back. At last he let her, and knelt before her, arms lowered.
"Ezra, if you need to hit me, then by the gods, hit me. If that's what you need, I won't fight you for a second, not ever. Just tell me what you want."
She balled her fists, and Jean braced himself for another swing, but she sank to her knees and wrapped her arms around his neck. Her tears were hot on his cheeks.
"How could you not tell me?" she whispered.
"Anything you want to know, I'll tell you now, just..."
"The poison, Jean!"
"Oh," he moaned, slumping sideways against the rear wall of the cabin. She slid with him.
"Oh, shit!" "You selfish bastard! How could you not..."
"Drakasha told the Council of Captains our story," Jean said numbly. "You were there to hear it."
"From her, not you! How could you do that to me?"
"Ezra, please, it's..."
"You are the only thing," she whispered through the iron grip of her embrace, "the only thing on this whole fucking ocean that's mine, Jean Tannen. I don't own this ship. Hell, I don't own this cabin. I don't have a buried fucking treasure. I have no family and no title, not any more. And then I finally got to take something in return.
And it turns out I have one significant flaw."
"We can do something," she said. "We can find someone. Physicers, alchemists."
"Tried, Ezra. Alchemists and poisoners. We need the antidote from Stragos, or an actual sample of his poison from which to create one."
"And didn't I deserve to know? What if you'd..."
"Dropped dead in here one night? Ezra, what if a redeemer had put his sword through my skull, or the crew had just murdered me on the day we met?"
"That's not you," she said. "That's not how someone like you dies. I know, I just know."
"Ezra, you've seen every one of my scars. You know I'm not..."
"This is different," she said. "This is something you can't just fight."
"Ezra, I am fighting it. I have been fighting it every single day since the Archon put the fucking thing in me. Leocanto and I count the days, do you understand? I would lie awake at night the first few weeks, and I was sure I could feel it doing something in me." He gulped and felt his own tears pouring down his face. "Look, when I'm in here, it doesn't exist, understand? When I'm with you, I can't feel it.
I don't care about it. This is... It's like a different world. How could I tell you? How could I ruin that?
I would kill him, she whispered. Stragos! Gods, if he was here right now, I'd cut his fucking throat.
I'd help, believe me.
She released her arms from around his neck, and they knelt there in the semi-darkness, staring at each other.
I love you, Jean, she whispered at last.
I love you, Ezri.
Saying it was like allowing some sudden release of pressure behind his heart. It felt like breathing in at last after ages spent underwater.
You're like no one else I've ever met.
I can't let you die, she said.
It's not you. You can't.
I can do what I damn well please, she said. I can get you to Tal'Varar. I can buy you time to get what you need from Stragos. I can help you kick his ass.
Ezri, said Jean, Drakasha's right. If I can't get what I need from him, taking Stragos down is more important.
Don't say it.
I'll do it, he said. It only makes sense. Gods, I don't want to, but if I have no choice, I'll trade myself for him.
Damn you, she whispered,
and faster than he could react, she leapt to her feet, seized him by the front of his tunic, and slammed him against the starboard bulkhead.
You will not! Not if we beat him, Jean Tannen! Not if we win!
But I have no choice.
Make a new choice, you son of a bitch!
She pinned him to the bulkhead with a kiss that was pure alchemy, and his hands found their way down her tunic, down to her breeches, where he unhitched her weapons belt with as much gratuitous fondling of the areas not covered by it as he could manage. She took the belt from his hands and flung it against one of the stiffened canvas walls, where it struck with a clattering racket and slid to the floor.
If there is no way, make a way, Jean Tannen. Losers don't fuck in this particular cabin.
He picked her up, making a seat for her from his crossed arms, and whirled her around so that her back was against the bulkhead and her feet were dangling. He kissed her breasts through her tunic, grinning at her reaction. He stopped to put his head against her chest, felt the rapid flutter of her heart beneath his left cheek.
I would have told you, he whispered, somehow.
Somehow indeed. Man, she said, what a mouse he is made by conversation.
Oh, it's not enough that I have to take this from you. Now I have Lucano chastising me.
Jean,
she interrupted, pressing his head more firmly against her with a hug.
Stay with me.
What?
This is a good life, she whispered. You suit it. We suit it. After we deal with Stragos, stay with me.
I like it here, said Jean. Sometimes I think I could stay forever. But there are other places I could show you. Other things we could do.
I'm not sure I'd adjust well to life on land.
Land has its pirates, same as the sea, he murmured between kisses. I'm one of them. You could...
Belay this. We don't have to decide anything now. Just think on what I said. I didn't bring you in here for negotiations.
What did you bring me here for?
Noise, she whispered, starting to pull his tunic off. Lots and lots of noise.
5. Just before the midnight change of watches, Gwilym emerged from his new quarters into the narrow corridor between the ship's four smaller cabins. Scowling, clad only in his breech-clout and a hastily thrown-on vest, he stepped across to the door of his old compartment. Bits of flannel rag were stuffed into his ears. He pounded on the door several times. When no answer was forthcoming, he knocked again and hollered,
"Tregann, you bitch! I'll get you for this!"
6. Are her preparations almost complete, then?
The two men met in the roofless ruins of a stone cottage, south of the city proper, so close to the edge of the eerie jungle that not even drunks and gazers would crawl out to it for shelter. It was near midnight, and a hard rain was falling, warm as spit.
"Got all our junk sold just this afternoon. Been taking on water and ale like crazy. More than enough food already. Once we scrape up everyone that wants to get scraped up tomorrow, I'm sure we're gone."
Jafrim Rodanov nodded, and for the 100th time cast his gaze around the broken house and its shadows. Anyone close enough to listen through the noise of the rain would have to be close enough to spot, he reckoned.
Drakasha said disturbing things when she called the council. What she told you about her plans once she's back at sea?
Nothing, said the other man. Peculiar. Usually she gives us a good week to get our skulls busted and our purses sucked dry. She's got a fire under her ass, and it's a mystery to the rest of us.
Of course, said Rodanov. She wouldn't tell you anything until you were on your way. But she said nothing about the Archon, about Talvara?
No. So what do you think she's...
I know exactly what she's doing. I'm just not entirely convinced it's wise. Rodanov sighed. She might call down a heap of shit on everyone in the Ghost Winds.
So now you...
Yeah.
Rodanov passed a purse over, giving it a shake so the coins within could be heard.
Just like we discussed. Keep your eyes open. Note what you see. I'll want to hear about it after.
And the other thing?
Got it here, said Rodanov, hefting an oilcloth satchel with a heavy weight inside. You're sure you have a place where this cannot be found?
My sea chest. Privilege of rank, right? Got a false bottom.
Good enough.